Hello, everybody.
Hello.
My name is Margie, and I serve the village in many ways, one of them being teaching staff. And today we have a wonderful session with Roy Himmerly. Roy is the professor of religion at Concordia College and has been for 20 years or so, right? And is going to be talking to us today about this question of being spiritual versus religious and what on earth and mystery have to do with our relationship to God and to each other and to ourselves. So it's going to be fantastic. This session is being recorded, so anything you say will be on the tape for the rest of the tape's life. So keep that in mind. And we have a session right after this one at 4, so also keep that in mind. And without further ado, Roy.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. And being a college professor and a pastor, I'm like a double dose of Lunesta. You know, I can put people to sleep, especially if you've been working all day. So just feel free to just fade in and out as you like. Let me just give you a little background into myself, first of all, and then we'll get into the topic for today. So I grew up not too far from here in a town called Odessa, Washington. It's kind of out by Spokane. And as the immigrant son of German Russians, who were really from the steppe regions of Russia, and kind of had to learn English to start school, so I kind of understand that immigrant coming to this country mentality a little bit. I went to Pacific Lutheran University, where I met my wife Peggy, who's in the back, and we got married and went off to Wartburg Theological Seminary, where I became a Lutheran pastor. Went to Williston, North Dakota, because I said I would go anywhere that the church wanted me to go, so that's called Williston. And we were out there for 5 years. At that time, I got the bug to go back to graduate school. I was very interested in my undergraduate degrees, which were in classics, religion, and philosophy, that I was very interested in medieval things, especially my the authors that kind of changed my life were J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Charles Williams, and all these great authors known as the Inklings, and I wanted to read what they had been reading, so I went to graduate school at Notre Dame and became a medievalist, and that's my area of expertise. C.S. Lewis says that one of the great tragedies of the modern era is that it has modern snobbery. And what it means by that, what Lewis means by that, is that we think that we are a lot smarter than people of the past. And in some ways that's true, says Lewis. It's true in the sense that our medical science is better, our scientific knowledge of the universe is better. But Lewis would argue that when it comes to the human condition, we have given up the wisdom of the past in favor of modern sorts of ideas. And so Lewis and Tolkien and others try to recapture this idea of trying to understand the human condition through great authors of the past. And that's kind of where I'm at. So that gives you a little bit of a perspective on where I'm coming from. One of the things that I'd like to do then is to go back 100 years in order to try to figure out a phenomenon that I find amongst my students. I've always asked, you know, you've been teaching for about 25 years at Concordia, what are the difference between students 25 years ago and today? And in order to answer that question, I'd like to go back to a very interesting guy by the name of Baron Friedrich von Hugo, who was raised in northern Italy. His father was the ambassador to Italy from England. And he grew up in a very privileged home, extremely intelligent man, and somebody, has anybody ever heard of him? Usually that's the response. No, nobody knows who Google is. But I think he has this interesting book. It's called The Elements of Religious Mysticism. It's only 800 pages long, and I read some of it with my students because the first part of it I think is quite interesting and insightful, although somewhat dated in part, so I'm going to update some of his ideas as we're going along. But I'd like to introduce you to him because, I mean, he's a formidable looking guy, okay? I wish I had hair like that, you know, kind of wanted that. But Hugo was living in a time that was remarkable. So you can see that he dies in 1925, and so he was a scholar through, he wrote Elements in 1908, and he was a scholar through a remarkable period of our history in the world. And one of the things that was going on was, I'm going to talk about a few tensions at that time. One of the tensions was between science and religion. And the science and religion tension started with Darwin, right? Origin of the Species. I mean, the science and religion tension had been there since the Age of the Enlightenment, but really Darwin kind of, who was a religious person himself, a very interesting guy, but if you go into his idea of the theory of evolution and that, suddenly there was an alternative to religious worldviews or explanations of how we came about as human beings. And there was an immediate tension, and what we see, the way religion reacted at the time was to immediately say, okay, the Bible is literally true. Nobody really argued that until the late 19th century. Literalism comes about at that time as a reaction to science and to scientific alternatives. And so these tensions started up. And the other sorts of tensions are other key figures that come along in the period. Famous Jewish author, atheist by the name of Sigmund Freud, started looking at the human condition from a psychological point of view, suggesting that we can look at people through dreams and things like that. And so we see this tension. Now, Hugo's living at this time, and he's struggling with the ideas that are coming up in his age. Another thing that we see, I'm going to move along fairly quickly to get to some of these ideas. Another tension that we see in the late 19th century, really starting in the early 20th century, is the idea of industrialization. This idea that you can use coal and start burning coal and making industry, and you're going to have steam engines, and all of a sudden there is now a new assault on what was known as tradition at the time. So tradition is the way we've always done things, right? And now technology emerges, and it allows you to travel across the United States in a locomotive in a time that would have taken settlers months. Now you can do it in a very short period of time. And so we see movements in the late 19th century, like in religious movements, and this is across the board in almost all religious traditions, like the Amish, who look at the advancement of technology and say, we're not going there. Technology has the ability to remove ourselves from the land and remove ourselves from who we are. And so Hasidic Jews, right, say we're staying at this period in the 19th century and we're not moving forward because we want to stay connected to what our values and our traditions are. And so there was this other tension. Now, Hugo was interesting because as he's living in the midst of these sorts of, as these trends are developing, he has the idea that science and religion don't need to be in conflict with each other. Tradition and modernity don't need to necessarily be in conflict with each other. So he's trying to figure out how religion works. And he suggests that he notices that there's really basic three elements for any valid religious tradition. And I use the word valid because what he would mean by this, and this comes out in his Mystical Elements of Religion, 1908, he says what he means by valid is the idea that a religion that is not based on compassion is not a valid religious tradition. A tradition that's based on hatred or cruelty is maybe called a religion, but it's been co-opted by its worst elements and therefore undermines what basically religious traditions are supposed to be about. So, he says that there's basically three elements that we want to look at when you think about religion. And the first one has to do with the idea of tradition. And Hugo said, why is it that tradition necessarily has to come into conflict with the ideas of modernity? For example, in the 1950s, and on, as television became a popular new technology, do you remember that there were religious movements that wouldn't allow people to watch television? Mm-hmm. Or the radio, although the radio was kind of eventually sneaks its way into homes, or various other sorts of traditions. And Hugo comes along and says, well,
if I think about it, tradition has a value in religion because this is the way we instruct our children, right? The very first thing we do is we bring our children, and you, if you're religious, you were taken to worship services, you memorized liturgies, you learned songs, you learned the Lord's Prayer, you learned all these sorts of things that were handed over to you. These are faith practices, worship practices. And that's the way we enter into religion. And so von Hubel says, yeah, these things can be very good. These are very valid. The second thing he said that every religious, valid religious tradition has is some sort of teaching. Now, tradition, another term that he uses for tradition is he uses institution. An institution is a means by which we organize the world around ourselves, right? Ritual is a way of giving meaning to the way we understand the world, right? Why is there evil? Why do we suffer? So on and so forth. And so that would be the institutional part. But when you get a little bit older, you need something more. It's like a developmental thing, says von Hubel. Now notice, he's kind of using psychological terms. He's using psychology to think about how we think about religion. So he's bringing these things together, right? And so he says, well, when we get to be a youth, what happens is we start teaching our children. We put them in Sunday school. We start reading the biblical stories. We start expecting them to listen to the sermon. We make them take sermon notes during Advent. We teach them about the Trinity. We teach them about these mysteries, and we give them these various doctrinal elements. And that's just the way it goes for von Hubel. So let me stop for a minute and just point out one thing before I get to the third element, which is really where I'm trying to go, because we tend to see religions or religious traditions based on these two things, right? And so we will see, von Hubel says, it's really interesting. If you look closely at religious traditions, they tend to emphasize one thing or another. So how many Roman Catholics do we have in the room? Okay, you can't answer this question. but it won't matter. Who is the Pope today?
Francis.
Pope Francis the First, right? Everybody pretty much, right? You all know that. What's that? Okay, who's the Pope? Who was the Pope before him?
Benedict
the 16th. Before him?
JP II.
We could probably keep going for a while, right? Now, von Hubel himself was Roman Catholic. He is the first Roman Catholic to get an honorary doctorate from Oxford after Oxford became a Protestant institution under Henry VIII. He's the first Roman Catholic to get this. And he recognizes that his own religious tradition, being Roman Catholic, has a strong traditional element. You know who the Pope is, you know who the bishops are, you understand the clear organizational, institutional structure, and there's an emphasis upon this. And I always say that. And then I go to my Lutheran students. How many of you are Lutherans? Okay, you're probably good Lutherans, so you probably know the answer to this. Who's the presiding bishop of the ELCA?
Elizabeth Eaton.
Elizabeth Eaton. Okay, so some of you, my students will go, have absolutely no clue, right? Now, why is that? And if I ask the Baptists or the Pentecostals in the room or whoever, what other Protestant tradition is there, I'll say, tell me who's kind of the most important person. They really struggle with that. And von Hubel says it's because Catholicism tends to emphasize tradition and Protestantism tends to emphasize teaching. It's more intellectual. So, for example, if I say to you Lutherans, sum up to me Luther's view of theology in one word or a few words, what would you say?
Grace.
Now, Roman Catholics, I'll put you back on the spot. If I said, sum up for me your teachings in Catholicism. I say that to my students, and I'm a Roman Catholic historian, and I would go, whoa, it's complicated, right? Because you have so many different traditions. You have the Benedictine monastic orders, you have the Franciscans that are different, and then you have all these different teachers. It's complicated. You couldn't do it, but Lutherans can do it in one word, right? See how quickly you can zone in on that. And so Hubel's point is that depending on which type of tradition you are, you're going to focus on different things. Now, Hugel would like to suggest that there is a third element to every religious tradition, and he's going to call this he'll use the word mysticism. The problem is that when I use the word mysticism in the classes, students start thinking tarot cards, they start thinking, what does mysticism mean? That word has kind of been co-opted in the modern world, kind of like New Age religious traditions and things like that. So I sometimes would just drop in the word mystery. And von Hugel says, once you get through these two parts, everybody kind of gets this part where you become an adult in the faith. And what that really means for von Hugel is that you get to this point where you say, somebody just died. I prayed for their healing and they died anyway. I thought God, if God loved me and if I prayed right, everything would be okay. And it's not. But I've been taught that. Or I've been taught that those people that are different than me, in my growing up in Odessa, that meant those Catholics that were kind of on the north side of the railroad tracks and us Protestants who were on the south side, that they were different. And then I'm going to school with them and I'm saying, why am I not supposed to like these people? Why are they different than me? You start raising questions. Your experience starts to cause you to crack open your faith a little bit and you start to wonder about it. And there are elements of wonder and awe. And so along come various people within religious traditions, says von Hugel, who will always be emphasizing either tradition, teaching, but sometimes along comes somebody who emphasizes the mystical side of faith, the experiential side of faith, the getting back to what von Hugel say would be the core of faith. So let's use an example. I grew up in Washington State, not far from here, and I remember being in grade school in the 1960s. And there was a tension in our society in the 1960s, right? And one of the tensions had to do with racial relations. We haven't come hardly anywhere, have we? And even though we think we have, we're still struggling with the same question. But I remember Martin Luther King Jr., right, suggesting to society, and much to the chagrin of people that I knew, that African Americans were equal people in God's eyes and therefore belonged to be a part of the traditions. But in the South, they couldn't drink out of water fountains, bathrooms, they couldn't use the same bathroom. What is it with bathrooms? They're still struggling with bathrooms, right? North Carolina. And laws about bathrooms with transgender folk. In any case, you have this sort of tension coming along, and Martin Luther King Jr. suggests that at the heart of it is love, right? At the heart of what God is about is compassion towards all people. And if that's true, then these laws that have been established, well, we need to deal with them. If you're really serious about it, you need to think differently. And this is the mystical side, a place where you create wonder and awe. Now, if you start thinking about mystics, some of them are on the walls around here. There's Martin Luther King Jr. there, a great picture, Mother Teresa, Sojourner Truth. You have all these wonderful people, these mystical people. Think about how they end up. How does Martin Luther King Jr. end up?
Assassinated.
Gandhi.
Assassinated.
The mystical tradition, when it starts calling into question the values of the traditions, the tradition can do this sometimes. If you're not Roman Catholic, you're not going to be saved. If you don't believe that you're saved by grace through faith, you're not going to be saved. If you don't believe in the four spiritual laws, you're not going to be saved. If you don't believe the way I believe, you're not going to be saved, right? And mystery always comes back and says, what is it that we're really about in the Christianity? And it's love. But to make that statement and to ask a society to move from where it was is a dangerous thing. It's a difficult thing. And often, you can list other mystics throughout history. Joan of Arc. They just don't end up often very well, do they? and
Jesus Christ.
And Jesus Christ. And this is one of Hugo's argument, that that's where Christ is coming from. This is not an easy way. This is a charge or a call to deal with the establishment of the society at that time. And so when I talk with my students and we read Hugo and we try to get through to this, suddenly the light bulb goes off. Because this is one of the great changes that I've seen in students over the last 25 years, and it's this. I am spiritual, but I'm not religious. Right? Have you heard that? Mm-hmm. And when I push the students and I say, well, what do you mean by that? And we've talked about this. One of them says, well, I don't really buy into any particular religious tradition. I do believe in the teachings of Christ. I do believe in compassion. I do believe in being kind. I believe in Black Lives Matter. I believe that we need to change our society. And I'm not really tied to a particular tradition, nor am I tied to a particular teaching. And so we have a lot of students, of young people. The Pew Foundation did this huge study and found that the fastest growing religious group in the United States is the nuns. People that say, I don't have any. Oh. It's going quick, not nuns, but none. No religious tradition. That's the fastest growing. You know? I did that on purpose. Yeah. So that you have this group out there that says, I don't want to be connected to particular traditions, because traditions are the types of things that cause division in society, or the type of people that are tied to certain teachings. And so as a result, they are looking for groups that are tied to compassion and tied to making a difference in society. And this is one of the interesting elements that we see. So von Hugo is looking at his time, and he says, listen, and I think his society is mirroring ours, right? We still have a tension between science and religion. Global warming, right? We have science saying, 98 out of every 100 scientists say we have global warming. We have entire religious traditions. I have a brother-in-law and sister-in-law that are part of a church that they say, oh, no, that's just, you know, a made-up thing, right? And want to deny the scientific thing. But when I ask where their convictions come from, it really comes from a religious conviction and belief, which comes out of not only a religious belief, but also political conviction, right, about how society should be structured. And so I think on that level, we're the same. I think, I kind of wonder if the Amish weren't right about technology, right? Just a sec, let me check Facebook. Right? I mean, are we closer to people because we have certain technologies in our phones? Or are we more distant? Another thing that I've seen in 25 years of students changing is their ability to articulate themselves either in written or oral form. It seems like it's becoming more difficult. Why? Because they're used to, I think, articulating themselves through a medium with each other, mostly, more often through technology than in one-on-one contact. That's not always true, but I think it is true to a degree. And so sometimes I think the Amish may have had it right, but I don't think we can put our heads in the sand, neither does von Hugo. And so he suggests we need to move forward. Well, so how do we move forward? How do we understand how mysticism really works in the world? And remember the great book of Job in the Old Testament. And Job he's had all this suffering. He's in this spot where he says, you know, God, I've trusted you. I did everything. And now my kids are all dead. And I've lost my family. And I've lost my home. And, you know, why are you doing this? I want you to come down here. I want to talk to you. Right? And this teaching doesn't work anymore. And you know the story of Job. God comes to Job in a whirlwind. Nature. Comes to God, Job in nature, and says, were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Answer me. Awe. Wonder. Okay. Job has nothing to say. Just the mere experience of God. I'm with you. Here's Job's words. I know that you can do all things. I have spoken about what I do not understand. The things of you are too wonderful for me, O God. I cannot know you, and I do not understand wisdom. I have heard you with my ears, I have seen you with my eyes, and so now I only can despise myself and throw myself in dust and ashes. Paul, in the New Testament, says, what are we about as Christians? He says, we are stewards of the mysteries of God in 1 Corinthians 4. I've already puzzled what he means by that. We are stewards of the mysteries. I have a feeling what he's getting at is that what we're really stewards of is the wonder and the greatness that God has established for us. So let me go back. I'm a historian. I go back to try to figure out answers in the present from the past. I try to think about how these things might have, how we might think about wonder. So I want to go back to the 5th century for a minute. In this, these questions, these tensions that I've been talking about between tradition, teaching, and mystery have always been a part of our society and are, perhaps are accentuated today. So there was this young man by the name of Benedict. He was living in Rome. He's living in this society. He's a member of a wealthy family. Everything is great, right? You know, he's got every advantage that he could think of. And then he just realizes that he's losing himself. He's losing himself in the society. He's losing himself in luxury. He's losing himself. He doesn't know what to do. So he decides that he's going to go south of Italy to a place, an old fort of Nero that's fallen in and broken down, and he's going to take some of those rocks, and he goes to a cave. It's called Subiaco. It's, this is the actual cave. I've taken students there a number of times. I travel with students to Europe a lot and take alumni tours. And so we went to Subiaco Cave, and it's just a tiny little cave, and there's a little replica of him, and there's a little basket where people would lower food down from. He says he realizes that the only way, his idea is that the only way he can change the world to make it come back to the core elements of love and compassion, which he thinks God wants him to do, is to escape it. I have to escape the world in order to change it. So, what does that mean? He goes out into the wilderness. Eventually, people start coming in. He forms really what's the foundation of Western monasticism, monastic movement. People start living in common. They share everything they have. They live in this community, and they this community then establishes doctors. And so medieval Europe is completely rural. There are no doctors. So the only doctors you can find through from 500 to the year 1000, what's sometimes called the Benedictine Age, were in Benedictine monasteries. You had to go to them. If you were poor and needed food, you would go to the Benedictine monasteries. If you had a child that was starving to death, didn't know what to do, you could leave it at the doorstep of a Benedictine monastery and they would take care of it. They became the center of compassion through the early Middle Ages. You change the world by removing yourself from it. But I wondered how this all came about. And the very first time I went to Subiaco, I was talking with Brother John, a 90-year-old Australian Benedictine monk who had been there for the last 60 years of his life. And he was talking to us, and I had read the dialogues of Gregory the Great, which talks about Benedict, and it always said that Benedict went to the wilderness. He always went to this, and it's this desolate place. But I got there, it was spectacularly beautiful. It was like olden. Waterfalls, mountains, the old fort from Nero just down on the hill. I'm standing there, one of my students was awestruck. She says, I think this is the most beautiful place I have ever been to. And I said to Brother John, I said, I've been reading Benedict all my life. I love Benedict, but I just hadn't expected this. And he looks at me and he says, well, what do you think? We're stupid? Of course we come to this place to find God. Of course we go to the most beautiful places in the world. That's what monks and nuns are all about. You think that we're escaping from the world in luxury, and we are escaping to the place where we see God most clearly. And it was Benedict's nature mysticism that helped transform him and medieval Europe into a society. If you've ever read the Thomas Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization. It was these crazy monks that went to Ireland and took the books with them. They kept the learning alive, the libraries, intellectual. They kept the spiritual, the emotional, the physical people alive by living in community, radical community, basing their entire lives on Acts chapter 4, verse 32, that they held everything in common. But it starts with a motivation to get out of the city, to get out of the concrete into nature and God's creation once again. Well, that's just one example. Benedict in Subiaco, south of Italy. Italy's a good place to go. There's a lot of great examples. I'm going to stop for a second and give you another example, but I want to talk about an idea. Geography, there's some scholars who've been writing recently about a guy by the name of Douglas Burton. Douglas Burton Christie has written a number of things on the idea of spiritual geography. And the idea that where we live profoundly affects who we are. I heard the story in Fargo, of all places where I'm from. I was talking with a family that brought some kids from New York City out there to Fargo in the summer, and they decided, we have spectacular sunsets in Fargo because there's nothing to block them. It's just this big, long horizon, and then we have these clouds in the evening, and the dust, if they're harvesting, it's spectacularly purple, and you know that. So they took these kids, these inner city kids, out of New York, and it took them out and showed them a sunset. They said, oh yeah, we're gonna go outside the city so you can really see it out in a wheat field or cornfield. And they're standing there and they were awestruck. And they said, we've never really seen this before. One of the greatest violences of our society is that we keep the poor in places where there is no beauty. And we remove them from the place of wonder and awe. And it didn't really dawn on me how violent that is until I heard that story. That, you know, why is Central Park the best part of New York? Yeah. Why are little parks and things so necessary and so often ignored by urban planners, especially in areas of the poor? Well, I want to move on to this man over on the wall over here, St. Francis of Assisi. Also, he is the next major religious movement within Europe at that time. What happens in the 12th century in Europe is that we see a huge influx of people from rural areas into cities. Rome goes from being a town of 50 to 100,000 suddenly to being, you know, a large million people. Why? Because commerce develops, merchants develop. And they start establishing cities throughout Europe in the 13th century. And one of the things that Benedictine monasticism cannot do is, because it's so removed from society, is get into the cities. And so along comes a guy, Francis of Assisi, again, a very wealthy merchant son. He starts living in a very wild playboy lifestyle. He was the Hugh Hefner of his day, you know, enjoying all sorts of fun. And then he decides he's going to go on crusade. There was all sorts of crusading going on, and he goes on crusade, and he's captured and gets a fever and nearly dies. They decide to let him go because they think he's dead. They take him back to his home, and out of this fevered pit, he begins to wonder what life was all about. Now, he lives in Assisi. Has anybody been to Assisi? Spectacular place, right? Like Holden, very different, but again, spectacular scenery. And Francis goes out, he starts walking the countryside. Everybody thinks he's gone nuts. His father thinks he's crazy. He wants him to get into the family business, make money. And Francis is out with the puppies and enjoying nature. And one day Francis sees the poor, the people of his own father's making, right? His father makes them dye clothes, and he takes them and takes them out of the basements and leads them into the sun, and he gives them clothes and he gives them money, and the father is furious and he drags him before the bishop and says, Bishop Guido, this is my son. He's a crazy man. What am I going to do with it? What should I do? And Francis says, I know what I'm going to do. He takes off all his clothes in the public square, hands them to his father and says, I have no earthly father anymore. and he goes out and he lives with the poor and the needy, and he forms the mendicant order. Mendicant means to beg. He's a beggar. And he becomes a beggar, and he says all he seeks is the joy of nature and to love those that are untouchable, that are unreachable, the lepers and the poorest in society. His motivation, though, is very, very, starts out with nature mysticism. When he's near his death, he writes one of the great hymns that I think, All Creatures of Our God and King, which is based on Psalm 148, which I'll just read a few lines. Most High, all-powerful, good Lord, to you alone we offer praise, glory, and honor. Most High, because they belong to you, and we are not worthy to call you by your name. Still we praise you, my Lord, for all your creatures, especially brother, son, who this day, through whom you give us light, and he is beauty and radiant and great splendor, and bears your likeness to us and makes us and reminds us of who you are. And our sister moon, and our brother wind, and our brother fire, and our mother earth, and our sister death, who brings us back to you. That's the only line he changes really out of Psalm 148. He adds a whole line about death. As his sister, who is a dear, loving, kind lady who helps him escape this world. Sorry, I think we hear the microphones. Technology. When I did my senior thesis in college on St. Francis, and I got there was an elderly great scholar by the name of Ray Petrie who was in a nursing home close by. I decided to go visit him and interview him when I found out he was there, and to see what he would say about Francis. And I said, I'm writing this my thesis on Francis and nature. And he said, I have to just read it to you because I wrote it down at the time. And he says, the thing I love about St. Francis and nature is that he taught us that you can clear away all the forests for parking lots. You can build concrete skyscrapers to the heavens so that you can't see the trees anymore. You can build your summer homes in the mountains and drive the wolves from their habitat. But in the end, what does it get you? I fear that the only legacy of such behavior will be our inability to find God in the world again. Nature mystics are kind of unexpected and all over the place. One of my favorites is Harriet Beecher Stowe. You know Harriet Beecher Stowe, right? Who is she? She wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? And she comes from a very wealthy, very religious family. Her brother was a very famous preacher during her day and age. She was one of the few women to get a wonderful education at that time because of her advantage. I don't know if you know that she wrote a number of hymns, a number of really beautiful hymns. This is one of my favorites. Still, still with thee when purple morning breaks, when the bird waketh and the shadows flee, fairer than the morning, lovelier than the daylight, dawns the sweet consciousness that I am with thee. Alone with thee amidst the mystic shadows, the solemn hush of nature newly born, alone with thee in breathless adoration, in the calm dew and the freshness of the morning. So shall it be in my last bright morning, when the soul waketh and the life's shadows flee. Oh, I in that hour, fairer than the daylight dawning, shall rise the glorious thought that I am with thee. Well, Harriet Beecher Stowe was a profound nature mystic, and she loved the beauty of this world. And we have, there's some wonderful biographies, this brand new one that I'm looking forward to read on Harriet Beecher Stowe that's just come out, that talks a lot about her love of nature and creation. But we find that Harriet was so moved by the beauty of nature that she could not abide the ugliness of the world. And one of the uglinesses of the world that she had, kind of talks about it as if it was a vision. She went to worship, and she was having communion. And while she was having communion, she had a vision of an African-American man dying in his home. And she said that that was the germ of Uncle Tom's Cabin. She decided to write a book that would expose the cruelty of slavery to the world at that time. Abraham Lincoln, when he met her, said, "So you're the little woman that caused this great war." Some people think that her book was a catalyst for the North to finally say, we've had enough, we are no longer going to allow slavery. Now notice that there's a pattern here. Nature mysticism moves people to think differently about the world. One of my favorite modern authors, Dorothy Zala, wrote a wonderful book called The Silent Cry, Mysticism and Resistance. And in her book, she suggests that the mystical worldview generally has three stages to it. The first part is that we come to experience wonder in our lives. Now notice, Benedict, Francis, Harriet Beecher Stowe, all of them, even von Hugel, come through their first step through nature. That's the amazement. And what that makes them do is it makes them let go of something. For Benedict, it's his life in the city. For Francis, it's his life of wealth. For Harriet Beecher Stowe, it's it helps her let go of the fear of taking a great risk with a novel like this. And by publishing that, you start resisting the society. You start resisting the ugliness of the world, and you start to try to make it beautiful again. And once we start thinking along these sorts of terms, we get back to Hugel's idea that this world is a place that we experience, a place that we experience wonder and compassion and beauty. And one of the things that I'm really struck by is that one of the last things that we are taught really in school is how to be compassionate. We don't really think about education as a place by which we move people to compassion, but we're really good at teaching competition. We're really good at teaching things that help divide us as opposed to help us overcome our division in a way that we can start thinking about how this world is affecting us. Hugel's idea is that we all need tradition, some sort of way of organizing the world. We all need some sort of teachings, but we can lose track of what is really important if we do not stay centered on compassion, love of God, love of neighbor, and love of creation. And whenever we start abusing any of those loves, we get into trouble. I would like to show you a quick video of something that kind of gets to this point, I think, well. This is a TED Talk that you can find on YouTube. And this is Louis Schwartzberg. I teach a course on religion and film. Film is 10 minutes long, it's short. But it talks about, I think, this nature mysticism and how it can change our society.
Hi everybody, I feel like I'm at a revival. This is great. Great to be back in my old stomping grounds in San Francisco. When I graduated UCLA, I moved to Northern California. And I lived in a little town called Elk on the Mendocino Coast. And I didn't have a phone or TV, but I had US mail. And life was good back then, if you could remember it. I'd go to the general store for a cup of coffee and a brownie. And I'd ship my film to San Francisco and lo and behold, 2 days later, it would end up on my front door, which was way better than having to fight the traffic of Hollywood. I didn't have much money, but I had time and a sense of wonder. So I started shooting time-lapse photography. It would take me a month to shoot a 4-minute roll of film, but that's all I could afford. I've been shooting time-lapse flowers continuously, non-stop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for over 30 years. And to see them move is a dance I'll never get tired of. Their beauty immerses us in color, taste, touch. It also provides a third of the food we eat. Beauty and seduction is nature's tool for survival because we protect what we fall in love with. It opens our hearts and makes us realize we are a part of nature and we're not separate from it. When we see ourselves in nature, it also connects us to every one of us because it's clear that it's all connected in one. When people see my images, a lot of times they'll say, "Oh my God." Have you ever wondered what that meant? The O means it caught your attention, it makes you present, it makes you mindful. The Y means it connects with something deep inside your soul. It creates a gateway to your inner voice to rise up and be heard. And God is that personal journey we all want to be on, to be inspired, to feel like we're connected to a universe that celebrates life. Did you know that 80% of the information we receive comes through our eyes? And if you compare light energy to musical scales, it would only be one octave that the naked eye can see, which is right in the middle. And aren't we grateful for our brains that can, you know, take this electrical impulse that comes from light energy to create images in order for us to explore our world? And aren't we grateful that we have hearts that can feel these vibrations in order for us to allow ourselves to feel the pleasure and the beauty of nature? Nature's beauty is a gift that cultivates appreciation and gratitude. So I have a gift I want to share with you today, a project I'm working on called Happiness Revealed. And it'll give us a glimpse into that perspective from the point of view of a child and an elderly man of that world.
When I watch TV, it's just some show that you just better pretend. And when you explore, you get more imagination than you already have. And when you get more imagination, it makes you want to go deeper in so you can get more and see beautiful things. Like, it could lead you to a beach or something, and it could be beautiful.
You think this is just another day in your life? It's not just another day. It's the one day that is given to you today. It's given to you. It's a gift. It's the only gift that you have right now, and the only appropriate response is gratefulness. If you do nothing else but to cultivate that response to the great gift that this unique day is, if you learn to respond as if it were the first day in your life, and the very last day, then you will have spent this day very well. Begin by opening your eyes and be surprised that you have eyes you can open. That incredible array of colors that is constantly offered to us for pure enjoyment. Look at the sky. So really look at the sky. So really note how different it is from moment to moment as clouds come and go. We just think of the weather. Even of the weather, we don't think of all the many nuances in weather. We just think of good weather and bad weather. this day, right now, has unique weather. Maybe a kind that will never exactly in that form come again. The formation of clouds in the sky will never be the same that it is right now. Open your eyes, look at that. Look at the faces of people you meet. Each one has an incredible story behind their face. A story that you could never fully fathom. Not only their own story, but the story of their ancestors. We all go back so far. And in this present moment, on this day, all the people you meet, all that life from generations and from so many places all over the world flows together and meets you here like a life-giving water if you only open your heart and drink. Open your heart to the incredible gifts that civilization gives to us. You flip a switch and there's electric light. You turn a faucet and there's warm water and cold water. And drinkable water. A gift that millions and millions in the world will never experience. So these are just a few of an enormous number of gifts to which we can open the heart. And so I wish you that you would open your heart to all these blessings and let them flow through you, that everyone you will meet on this day will be blessed by you. Just by your eyes, by your smile, by your touch, just by your presence. Let the gratefulness overflow into blessing all around you. And then it will really be a good day.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So I'm giving you a lot to think about, thought a little bit about mysticism. I know I've rushed through it, but I'm actually setting up what I'm trying to do for the next two times. I want to go back to another medieval tradition, Celtic Christian spirituality in Ireland, especially connected to the ideas of spirituality. And I think they have some very interesting things that we can learn from. And I've been working a lot with C.S. Lewis as an author, and when I heard I was going to give this talk on nature and creation, I thought there's a really, I think, interesting story in C.S. Lewis and his view of nature, and so those are my next few talks, Celtic Spirituality, C.S. Lewis. I have a couple minutes for questions or thoughts, yeah.
Could you say just a little more about what that young girl said about television? I didn't understand a lot. We're hearing aids, it's very hard.
She said that she would rather use imagination than, you know, because you have more of it when you use it than less, and when you don't use it. Okay. But I should say the old man, I had to do some research on who that old man was. I thought that man was particularly interesting, his voice. But the movie implies it that it's that old man with the pipe. It's actually not. He's a Benedictine monk. And I thought that made sense to me when I found out who that was. I did a little research on this movie. So kind of gets it back to Benedict.
I have so many questions, but I'm probably not a two-minute answer. But, so with the whole young people sort of wanting to jump to mysticism, and I feel like that happened in my sort of faith journey. Like, Can you skip? I mean, can you? I feel like C.S. Lewis, in particular, and Henry now, it kind of says you kind of need the tradition, the teaching, in order to get to mysticism, or in order to get to the contemplative place where you understand and can ask those deep questions. But I feel like there was a generation, my daughter's 19, who wants to get there without doing the, the wrestling with the past or the history or the reading or the research or the, it's learning.
You're raising the one thing I decided to skip as I went through, and I think this is a really important question. Hugel thinks that where mysticism goes wrong is if it just tries to stay by itself and it becomes individualized. And you'll see that in like a David Koresh or somebody, who kind of sees themselves as the answer, but then they lose, with the mysticism, they see themselves as kind of a godlike figure, and therefore whatever they say is true, and then all of a sudden they lose track of the compassion and it loses validity. So you're right, Hugel would argue that you need to be grounded somehow in some sort of tradition and some sort of teachings, but I think what we're seeing today is that there is an innate sense amongst all of us that there's a sense of awe and wonder. I'm going to talk more about this as we get farther on about what really is mysticism, how does it work. One of the points of it is that it's very fleeting. Mm-hmm. You may have felt it when you walk along here, and all of a sudden you're standing off something, and then you feel like you've got something, and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. And so that there's this awareness that there's something more to life. And that's C.S. Lewis. I'm going to talk about joy, longing for longing. Mm-hmm. That there's this sort of longing that we have. But von Hugel would argue that what is most helpful is to find a true compassionate tradition. My daughter, who's a NICU nurse, just had a baby, and her husband, who's a nurse as well, moved to Portland, and we've been kind of church shopping with them, and it's really interesting to see them react to what they think works for them and what doesn't. And what seems more rigid and traditional. It's interesting, I think Holden is a really unique place because Holden hangs on to the tradition but is really open to the mystical. Yeah. And that's, I think, in some ways for me, Holden is kind of the best of what the church can be for me. But where it kind of hangs on to that, but it hangs on to it in a compassionate way, not in a rigid rigid way, which we often find in our societies. But I think you're right. Yeah, von Hugel doesn't think mysticism can exist in a vacuum because you lose perspective.
I look forward to hearing
that. Yeah, we'll talk more about that.
Okay.
One minute.
Yeah. Would you mind just repeating the name of the guy whose TEDx talk?
That was Louis Schwartzberg.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's a great filmmaker. He does time-lapse stuff. I do a religion and film class. I really like this guy a lot. And I use this film often to start off my introduction to religion course. And my students seem to get it, through something like this. I think the film has a power to move. And that's what I want to try to do, is move students early on and then try to say, why does this matter? But so often, have you ever heard somebody say, I'm closer to God fishing than I am in a worship service? Mm-hmm. I think sometimes that's true. I've been to some worship services. I wish I was fishing. I'm out of time. Matthew is up next. Thank you.